Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcasts with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we welcome on another guest from SatoshiPay, the founder and CEO, Meinhard Benn. Hello, Meinhard, and welcome. Willkommen.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Kenny.
Yeah. Hi, Meinhard. How's things?
Things are good. Things are good, considering the circumstances. Really good. It's a very sunny day here in Berlin, and I'm looking out at a park. So, yeah, couldn't be better.
Yeah. Well, I believe you guys have pretty much starting to sort of open up for business and sort of normality. A few weeks ahead of us, anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't really call it normality. It's the new normal, obviously. And not to go too much into it, I think we started with testing very, very early, and that's why we have a very low case number. If you look at the graph of active cases, we are kind of at beginning of March levels back in Germany. So politics feel comfortable with opening up things again.
Yeah, Germany seem to do much better than other countries, but I think you're right. It's due to that the testing that you got on top of it pretty quick, which is nice to see. Set an example for the rest of the world, eh?
And interesting enough, and we might get into this later, so it's due to a decentralized infrastructure, actually, that proved to be more efficient than centralized infrastructures for testing. So that was kind of the part why we excelled at that. It's like, we have lab structures that are around the country, which have a certain autonomy how they distribute and develop tests according to sort of an open source pattern that was given out by the central research institutions.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's good.
And has it been business life as normal for SatoshiPay, Meinhard, or you had to make a few changes in the last couple of months?
Yeah, we had to make changes. We are relatively normal. In terms of how we go about business, we are we put people on short-time work, meaning people work half of the time, and we get some government subsidy for their salary that's not being paid in part. So the government supports us here. But considering that, we have quite good progress even in the last few months with what we're doing. And even some things we're more focused about because just we have less resources in terms of time. So we need to really cut the fat in some places and cut projects that we're just doing to move them forward to see where they go. But now we really have to focus on what's actually bringing us to, things that we want to bring to the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Obviously, we'll get on to SatoshiPay in detail later. But what we like to do in Fairbairn and Russell is actually get a bit of background about yourself, what you've done in previous business ventures, your education, your childhood, if you want to go back that far, and just really what motivates you and drives you to make this business a success. So really the floor's yours. You can go back as far as you want and just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so it's all connected, and as you would expect from someone working in the crypto blockchain Bitcoin space initially, my CV is not the average one. So I started programming when I was 12. So I'm definitely a technical person, but I was always interested in drawing and sort of creatively using technology as well. Mm-hmm. And that kind of is going through my life until now. And that also means I never had a formal education in terms of studies. And also I was never employed in my life, really. There was a brief period where I was a computer games tester just kind of for fun, and that wasn't actual employment. But otherwise, I was always self-employed and sort of building my own projects and companies, NGOs, and other sort of non-profit ventures that I went into. I was 12 and I started programming. This was just after the Berlin Wall came down. Also, I grew up in East Germany. There was no access to computers, but as soon as I could in 89, 90, I got my first computer. And because there was no software around, there was also no internet around, I had to write my own games for the hardware that I had, two joysticks, and I kind of had to invent something to kind of use the hardware that I have. And that kind of was already a moment where I felt this DIY culture and where also an open sharing of software, not just like, not in terms of piracy, but really like in a legal and open sharing of code. Mm-hmm. Started to inspire me and everything I did. I got my, you know, I got the code from magazines. I could just modify it and then kind of work with that. So very early on, I learned the advantages of that. And then during my school time, already in, I think it was 94, 95, I built my first websites for a local internet service provider and then for a local newspaper in my hometown, Schwerin. And then I already earned my first money with computers. So that was pretty cool. And then as we move forward into, let's say, 1998, 99, I was more of a freelancer in sometimes graphic design, web design, which was an area there was no studies available at the time. There was information science, computer science, mm-hmm. and then there was sort of media design, but there was nothing on the crossroads of that. So that's why I decided not to study and continue with my actually well-paid jobs at the time. So in 99, as you probably are aware, there was the first internet boom, or as it turned out, a bit of a bubble. Mm. So budgets for freelancers were very high, and I enjoyed quite a good salary at the age of 21 already. And then I moved, I briefly visited the US, where I saw a few business ideas also in the internet space. And one of them was internet surf terminals, so machines, you could feed them with dollar notes and youth hostels, and you could then access the internet. And we brought this idea, and this is together with my current co-founder, Alex, already in 99-2000 to Germany. And we were running these internet machines in German youth hostels all over Germany at about 20 locations. And that was my first real startup. We had external funding. And we had different funding rounds, and we deployed this hardware and software, and also we're managing and running these terminals across quite a bit of land within Germany. So after that, Alex continued to work in Berlin at different startups, but I myself, I realized, okay, I know how building a startup works now. I want to explore other things, and I want to travel the world. So that's when I really started traveling on a shoestring budget up to 50 countries. And a lot of that was done by hitchhiking or, just like very, very low budget travel and visiting various projects in the nonprofit space. This is also the time when I was co-founding two or three nonprofits, some in social justice, some in environmental activism, some to do with open source software, and the hosting of websites on open source and green energy, actually. So already in 2003, 2004, we were starting a product project that was hosting websites on renewable energy, which at the time, this green IT thing was pretty new. And we quite enjoyed quite a run on our system or on our service from various NGOs that we were in contact with. So, and during that time also explored alternative monetary systems, including the Brixton Pound, which was sort of a paper-based system. And there were other local exchange trade systems, which also involved some software and some sort of points that you gave each other. But all this was pretty centralized. There was one Java server, some slow-moving server software that was installed on one machine. If that machine was down, the network was down, and so the point system was down. So only then I saw, okay, this needs a decentralized solution. This was around 2007, 2008, when I looked around these technologies. And then I continued traveling, and during my travels, I got, I think I saw it on a news website somewhere, or someone sent it to me, a peer-to-peer decentralized system for creating currency or for moving currency. It was called Bitcoin. This was in 2011. And I realized immediately, okay, this combines all the things that are needed with what I want to do in life and what I want to see in the world. So I kind of stopped what I was doing at the time and got into this ecosystem deeply. I started mining Bitcoin and I was playing around with that. I traded a few Bitcoins and kind of saw, okay, this is a very early and emerging ecosystem, and it needs also a startup ecosystem, or like a startup ecosystem should join with this. And that's sort of what happened in 2013 when first venture capital was given out. I worked with one or two startups, one in the mining space, one in the personal remittance space, that were based on Bitcoin. And in 2014, I realized, okay, I want to do something myself, and it should be it should revolve around payments, because payments or value transfer is something that all blockchains at the time, which was Bitcoin and one or two other blockchains, can do really, really well. And I mean, that's the kind of the basic functionality. So you set up a blockchain that can transfer value, and then all the other features like smart contracts and, you know, oracles and voting, these kind of things are added on top of that. But yeah, value transfer is what they can do very well, where they are excelling in speed and also transaction costs. This was at the time Bitcoin was really cheap to transact, and it's decentralized. You can't pull the plug. So I started writing a system, which was already called Satoshi Pay. And it was enabling payments on websites for e-commerce. And I wrote this on a weekend at a desk of a friend of mine, at the kitchen desk. And on Monday, I had something that I could deploy on a website, and it could accept payments from anywhere in the world. And during that weekend, I didn't send a single fax. I asked anyone for permission. I didn't ask anyone for permission. And I just kind of downloaded software, spun up a few servers, and plugged it all together. And it was there. It was functioning. And this was really an enlightening moment that this permissionless innovation that this technology promised is really being delivered. And it opens the field for really, really experimenting with something that was before that behind closed doors and very, very heavily over-regulated. Regulated for good reason, because technology was sort of faulty then. It was depending on, let's say, gatekeepers that can be corrupted. But in this decentralized crypto world, the gatekeepers were math, essentially. So it was predefined software contracts and math. And if you review the math and just follow that, you are safe, right? So there's nothing really that can be cracked. And that was such strong encryption that we all knew can't be cracked. And so therefore a lot less regulation is needed, because, you know, the gatekeepers are, you know, is just technology and algorithms. Yeah, so that's kind of a long-winded way to say that I started Satoshi Pay as a payments company, simply because payments is something that reaches everywhere in life. You know, everything is a value transaction, may it be monetary or in some other way, represented by some other token or some other exchange, and it reaches, you know, two mobile phones, anything you do, really, everyday transactions, and also exchanging software. There's always the possibility to attach a value to that and to really put them to a decentralized system and add values or services around that. So companies can use this quite complicated technology easily. That was the goal. So our value add is always to make it really easy to access this quite complicated technology.
Yeah,
it's certainly an interesting journey, and it's quite astonishing to think that Satoshi Pay was founded over a weekend, sitting in somebody's desk in their kitchen. It's
it's not a garage story. It didn't start in the garage.
Yeah,
I don't have a car personally, but yeah, it was a kitchen in Berlin, and so it's that spirit. It's this DIY, do it yourself. You know, just take the tools and just do it. Don't ask anyone. Don't necessarily even find people to do it with. Just kind of do a prototype and then inspire people by that, by presenting it to your friends or, you know, someone, you know, from the startup ecosystem before, or even the nonprofit ecosystem that I was involved in.
Yeah. And the idea came from the rise of Bitcoin and that idea of the blockchain and the decentralized ledger. Is that what you said when you were traveling?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin was the first blockchain that was out there.
Yeah.
And the only one for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And that was definitely the inspiration for that. I had not envisioned that it would mushroom into thousands of different blockchains. I thought maybe 2 or 3 or 5 might be enough. But yeah, now we have this ecosystem that really was this Cambrian explosion about 2 years ago, where it just grew mushroom-like in all directions, which is fascinating to see how big it has become. So the first few Bitcoin meetups in 2012, 2013 here in Berlin, it was like 5 people. It was like once every month or once every 2 months, I believe. And, you know, everybody knew everybody. And what has become out of this real industry with thousands of people in Berlin alone, is just really, really fascinating. I'm great. I'm very grateful that this happened with the technology that I feel so passionately for.
Yeah. Okay. And Satoshi Pay is... it's not a cryptocurrency. It's a payment system based on the open ledger, the blockchain. For doing for doing payments globally.
Correct.
I guess. Yeah.
Correct. And so we always made it a point that we don't start our own currency because I really believe everything is out there and people that are a lot smarter than we are building better blockchains that we could ever build. Mm. And so we looked around. So that's kind of the next step in our evolution is when Bitcoin became sort of too popular for its own sake.
Yeah.
When it was kind of cloaked up, this was around 2016-17, the transaction prices went up quite significantly from a few cents or even below a cent to sometimes a few euros or pounds per transaction, each transaction. So for our micropayments use case that we were doing at the time, this was not very feasible anymore. So we needed to look for other systems that are more optimized for the small and fast transactions that we needed. So that's we had a look around the market, did a technical analysis, and after some brief experiments in other cryptocurrencies or other blockchains, we found the Stellar network, published by the Stellar Development Foundation, to be the network that really fits our needs. So we contacted them, the Stellar Foundation, and said, hey, we want to work with your technology. We know we can just use your network, but is anything you want to collaborate with us on, or can you give us some support? And that's really started a wonderful partnership with the Stellar Development Foundation.
Right. Okay.
So the payments platform is kind of split into its micropayments, B2B, and digital wallets. Could you give us an overview, Einhard, of what those three entail?
Yeah. So traditionally, we, as I said, we started with this micropayments use case. So for digital content, you want to buy a news article and not get into a subscription with a website. You can, with our technology, just buy one article for, let's say, 10, 20, 30 cents, and then kind of continue reading instantly after paying. It's one click. Then the article will be revealed, and that's it. So you don't have to have a subscription. You go to another website. You can use your remaining funds on your prepaid wallet on that website. So it's kind of like pocket change that you can spend around the web. That's what we've built with the original micropayment service. And then mid of last year, we looked around, okay, what else can we do with our technology? So we can apply the same technology, the Stellar-based payment system, also to macro payments, to very big payments, and offer a money transfer service for businesses specifically. We picked the businesses or the B2B space because it's the largest payment market in existence with the highest volume. We're talking trillions here every year that are being moved around mainly by commercial banks at the moment, which often is slow, high fees, intransparent fees, the foreign exchange isn't always clear, and that's kind of where they make most of the profit in some cases. Slow, expensive, and not really transparent. And we fix all of these three things. We make it a lot faster. We talk about seconds sometimes here for a bank-to-bank transaction. And we make it a lot cheaper. We cut off a lot of basis points of the banking fees, let's say, and also transparent foreign exchange and also transparent position of your money. So where's your money held at the moment? Because if it is held sometimes even for a few seconds or minutes, you can see where it is. Because that's the complaints we heard from businesses around the world, that sometimes money is stuck somewhere in the US, although they sent, let's say, from Mexico to Brazil, and it's routed through the US, and the US has some sanctions or has some extra checks that they need to do, and it's held up there, and sometimes it's coming back, and you only find out after calling your bank and after a few weeks. So that's obviously not acceptable for a lot of businesses. And that's really where blockchain technology, with its transparency, can help a lot. So we applied our technology to that. And we are currently building a service, and we are doing our first test transactions between different corridors around the world, where companies are sending money, let's say, from the US to Europe, or from Europe to Africa somewhere, or the other way around. So that's something we are building and starting to offer very, very soon, actually, to the general public. Not so much the public, but businesses around the world, because it's a pure B2B play. Simply because of the recurring nature of transactions and also the ongoing business relationships and volume that we are expecting and projecting. And we have signed up a few clients, SMEs from around the world, that will use our service once it's ready and create several million in volume, actually, just from these few letters that we have signed with these companies. So the third area is our digital wallets department, let's say, with a product called Solar Wallet, which is a protocol implementation for the Stellar network. The Stellar network, with its features that are built into the network, like trading, you can trade on the network directly. You can have some order matching. So let's say you want to buy euros for US dollars, you can do that on the network directly, or you can buy bitcoins as well, or bitcoin bitcoin tokens, let's say, and you can do that on the network. So our wallet supports that. Also, support for stable coins that are issued on the Stellar network. A stable coin is the representation of, let's say, a fiat or a currency that we're used to. The British pound can be used on the, or can be moved around on the Stellar network with the same properties as any normal Stellar transaction, meaning you can transact within 5 seconds for a fraction of a cent or of a penny in transaction fees. And you can see exactly when the money arrives, and just at a transparency level that you cannot achieve with normal banks normally. So that's why stablecoins are becoming more and more an important element of any sort of blockchain.
And what's the Stellar network, Meinhard?
Yeah, so the Stellar network, I mean, you have not just one blockchain in the world. You have, as I mentioned, thousands of blockchains, Bitcoin being the biggest one and the most known one. Then you have also the Ripple network, which is its own blockchain, its own sort of decentralized settlement network. And you have Ethereum, and you have a couple of others, Litecoin and so on. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the Stellar network.
Okay,
and right. All these networks, they run in parallel. They kind of have sometimes interlinking let's say elements, but they mainly run by themselves independently, and they all have different properties. Some are optimized for speed, some are optimized for transaction costs, some are optimized for a massive scale of transactions, like millions per second, and some are optimized for censorship resistance, which is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is very much optimized for that you can't pull the plug on a few companies and then you shut down the network. That's not simply not possible with Bitcoin. With networks like Ripple, which are optimized for speed and transaction costs, this is in theory possible. You could shut down a few entities that are running the main nodes of the Ripple network, including the Ripple company or the company that runs the network code. Mm. The advantage here is that they are a lot faster and cheaper in transactions. So it's sort of a trade-off that you have to meet. So the Stellar network is, by its technology, quite similar to the Ripple network, meaning it's very fast and cheap in transacting, and it works with trusted entities. So you have some banks participating in the network. You have, for example, IBM participating in the network. Also, Satoshi Pay runs a large number of nodes that are trusted by the network. And this predefined trust makes it a lot more efficient also in terms of energy. So you always hear the criticism that Bitcoin is consuming large amounts of energy around the planet, a few percent of the world's energy. So that's not the case for these networks that are optimized for speed and transaction fees. They consume the same as maybe a small data center running email servers or something, or web servers. So it's a very different technology with different energy needs. So okay. Yeah, Stellar Network, its own blockchain.
Okay, and in terms of I don't know, the sort of the real world use or the customer facing use of Satoshi Pay. You've got the three different areas that you said. So how does it work? What's the front end, so to speak? If a transaction happens online, is Satoshi Pay something that can work in the background that, you know, the end user never sees? And is it also something that you can have an account with, for example? I'm just wondering what, you know, for example, I'm thinking of when you do transactions online, you can use something like PayPal or, you know, another one of these sort of, you know, companies, brands that do all that kind of thing. I just wondered what's the situation with Satoshi? Is it visible to the end user, or is it more of a background running thing?
So it's both, but we also supply front ends in all three areas. So right, let's say okay. In the micropayments case, it's a website widget. You come to a website that supports Satoshi Pay payments, and you will just see a little widget or a little button that says pay here using Satoshi Pay. And this will then initiate a transaction with the balance that you have with the Satoshi Pay service.
Okay, yeah, so a customer would need a Satoshi Pay account to do that.
So we actually did a little trick here. It's not mandatory. It's optional to have an account. We want to lower the barrier to micropayments as much as possible.
Yeah.
So you can start as sort of in a guest mode. You can just top up using PayPal. And then you have a balance in a guest mode.
Okay.
And you can start get started straight away. So the only onboarding is this initial top up. You can even get some free credits from some of our giveaways. And you don't even have to top up. So it's very, very easy to start this way.
Okay.
But then optionally, if you want to sync between devices and if you want to kind of move the account to another device, you can sign up for a user account and you can use that user account. So that's the micropayment area.
Okay.
And that's kind of similar to a one-click PayPal solution, let's say. It's just kind of really embedded with a website, one click, and it deducts from your existing balance. So then we have the B2B cross-border transfer service. And that is in a way similar to something maybe, you know, TransferWise or other remittance companies, where you have a backend. It looks a bit like an online banking system. You log in, you say, I want to send money to this bank account in, let's say, Nigeria. You put in the bank details there. And this initiates a transfer either from your existing balance or tells you, okay, send a bank transfer to this, let's say, UK bank.
Okay. Yeah.
And we sort of forward it and we do all the all the conversion in between. So very similar to existing transfer services, but with the element of blockchain in between that sort of settles between the different countries. So where you have interbanking networks like SWIFT, for example, normally in the normal banking world, in the traditional transfer world, we use the Stellar blockchain as a replacement, for example, for the SWIFT network.
Okay, yeah.
And so that's the front end there. It looks very much like a, let's say, online banking.
Okay.
And for the third service, the digital wallet, we also supply a front end, and it's an app that you can download. So it's called Solar Wallet. You can download it for iOS, Mac computers, Windows, and also for Android. And you install it on your system, and you create an account. And this is not an account that we centrally store. It's an account that lives on your device. So that means you have full custody of your funds. We cannot block your funds. We cannot confiscate your funds. Or, it's really in your power to move these funds. That's the beautiful thing about cryptocurrencies, about blockchains, that you are the full custodian of your own funds.
Sure. Okay. Okay. And do you, what about that? I know you with Bitcoin and those kind of wallets, you need these sort of keys, don't you? Is that all within the app then?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We try to make it as simple as possible. You can back up the key. That's an optional backup. Obviously, if you lose your device or the hard disk crashes or you lose your device, that might be gone if you haven't made a backup. So the backup, push you to do the backup, but it's really up to you. But this also means we can't refund you if you lose your wallet because it's not for us. We supply the software that you can use to manage your own funds.
Okay, I understand.
So looking ahead, Meinhard, what is the roadmap for Satoshi? Let's say in the next sort of year to 2 years, you must have a rough idea what you want to grow the company to.
Sure, we actually have pretty precise ideas. We do financial projections and we have to have quite strict milestones. And this comes back to how we need to focus on really doing the right thing at the moment. That also means we have a quite tight milestone timeline. And we're focusing mainly on bringing the B2B service, the B2B transfer service on the road. And that's something that's going to happen in the next few weeks and months. In the next few weeks, we'll have an alpha version live where we have sort of an invite-only service where we work with clients that we have already signed. People can always approach us if they have a use case for a corridor that we might support in the early future. And they have a business and expect a certain volume, we are happy to work with these people as alpha clients. Then there will be a beta release, most likely in the third quarter. Without, I don't want to be nailed down on that. I need to look at the product roadmap that we have for giving exact dates. So that's a beta service that's a bit more open. There's going to be more of a self-service sign-up, and more people will be allowed on the platform. We do this quite careful approach to make absolutely sure. I mean, we're doing financial transactions here of sometimes significant value, let's say 100,000, 200,000 pounds per transaction. So we need to be absolutely sure that we're building the most secure and safe system that we can build. And then towards the end of the year, we will open that up to kind of open signups for all businesses. And that's really when the growth story starts, where with each client that signs up and that makes transactions, all volume grows. And that's what's most part of next year will be focused on growing the transaction volume, growing into different corridors. And corridors is sort of the term in the transaction in the money transfer world for different countries being connected with our technology. Let's say we start then between Japan and US or Japan and Europe. And these corridors will be opened up one by one with local partners always, because that's the power of the Stellar network. There's local partners that are connected to the Stellar network, and we help them to connect to the Stellar network, which means they're not just accessible to us. We might have a different pricing agreement with these guys. But as soon as someone joins the Stellar network, we can immediately open up a corridor to that entity or to that country, let's say. So that's what next year we'll be focused on. And also building out into different languages and, growing into different markets. And 2022 will be quite similar, where we will also push more towards the digital wallet space. When, let's say, the acceptance of digital currencies and also digital stable coins will grow, and we will tap into that. And that's kind of the plan, which is a bit further away. If everything runs on digital tokens instead of bank accounts, we will have already a product in place to serve this future world. So that's kind of let's call it moonshot in the digital wallet space. We need digital wallets anyway to test our service and also to link traditional banking infrastructure too. But we envision a world where all this is completely decentralized and in the hands of people, so people can control their own funds, which will make it a lot more secure and also a lot faster and cheaper and efficient. This also helps the unbanked and the underbanked to get sort of a store of value where they don't have anything right now. Let's say someone in a remote area of India doesn't have access to ATM infrastructure, but they could then use digital wallets to exchange funds between each other and also with the world. This happens in Africa, for example. You have services that are connected to mobile phones, like M-Pesa, that purely grew on mobile phones. People had these feature phones, not even smartphones, and that's how they pay each other. They are somewhere where there's only very minimal coverage and only very limited devices available, and they started using that as their everyday payment. And they are, in that sense, more modern than some parts even of Germany, where the only method you can send some money digitally is a bank transfer that takes a day or two. And there it's almost instant.
I never thought of it like that, actually. That's a really good point, because as you say, ATMs in Africa, few and far between, I suppose. But the phones are becoming more everywhere worldwide. That's a really good a good use of that. I never considered that.
Yeah, and I'm just looking. Some of these annual transaction fees for the cross border payments are huge. Mine had like £170 billion annually in fees. I mean, it's a huge market you're trying to tap into.
Absolutely. It's the biggest payment market in existence. It's really, we did a good research on where we could apply our technology. We looked at remittance quite early. And then we looked at what the remittance space or the money transfer space, also entails, and which parts are really the ones with the biggest volume. And B2B is by far the biggest one. It is also obviously, because it is a busy market, it has a lot of competitors. But it's a quite fragmented market. Payment in general is, but especially in the money transfer space, it's fragmented by geography, by industries, and also sometimes by technology and how much people are engaging with technology and how good they are at this and what kind of user experience they expect. So we are tapping into this user experience of, let's say, consumer apps, but for businesses. So that's a trend recently where you have a PayPal-like experience, but you want to have the same thing if you want to send money to your supplier somewhere, let's say in China or in India. And that's really what we're building at the moment. And we see quite a lot of growth there. So, it's such a big market that even a new player like us in that market, if we have only a small, tiny advantage that can sell well, we have a huge chance to become this hidden giant in this industry.
And in terms of the app, then the customer thing, you said that that's coming a bit later? Is it the actual sort of more push on that? Is that what you said?
Yes. So we're starting with a hosted backend, which, you know, you log in to a backend on the website. The same backend can be available on the website, on an app, but this fully self-custodial app experience for the fully digital world, that's coming later.
Yeah, so as an end user, because I was just Googling, there's nothing actually out there for the end user now to have something at the moment.
You mean the Satoshi Pay B2B service?
No, the wallet. I guess, was it the wallet you called it, where you could transact in different currencies?
Yes. So no, we don't have a Satoshi Pay B2B app available at this point. We have the Solar wallet available, but the B2B app will come later. We're focusing on the web app at the moment. So
the web app,
the service accessible through a website.
And you said, what's the app? Solar app? You said
Solar wallet, like sun. Solar panel, solar wallet.
Right.
That is the app. It's an open source app, essentially making it possible for you to use the Stellar network efficiently and all the features.
And transact in different cryptocurrencies that you like.
Yes, mainly the Stellar network.
Okay.
The Stellar crypto, the native cryptocurrency of the Stellar network, which is called Lumens. But there is, and that's where it gets a bit complicated.
Okay.
Representations of other currencies on the Stellar network. So you can use the Stellar network to move around funds that are not actually native to the Stellar network. This can be even shares. It can be votes for something, or it can be other cryptocurrencies, or let's say stable coins like the pound or euro and US dollar.
Okay. Yeah. So that's Solar. That is your product.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. I understand. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah, so Meinhard, just a question. What competitors are out in the market? Have you got any competitors? That's probably the better way to phrase the question.
It would be foolish to say no. Obviously, we have competitors in all of these areas.
Yeah.
In the micropayments space, not so many, actually. It's also because micropayments face a bit of a difficulty, not from the user's side. Users love micropayments. They, you know, instead of having a subscription to a new service or to any sort of online service, they would like to pay just as you go, right? They would just like to pay one video here, one news article there, without entering into subscriptions with all of these services. So that's really what the users want. However, the publishers that sit on the content and the content rights, they like subscriptions a lot because they have a steady income, and they will have an income even if the users don't use the service. You know how it is. You enter a subscription and then you don't read that newspaper in 2 months and you're still paying for that. That's always to the advantage of the publisher of that newspaper. Mm-hmm. And that's why most newspapers are optimizing for subscriptions at the moment. That poses a bit of a difficulty for a micropayment service. And also, for the size of the market, that currently limits the size of the market. We see that there's going to be a saturation soon with subscriptions where people just don't subscribe anymore.
Yeah.
And these publishers will look for alternative monetization methods that are between advertising and subscription. Mm. And that's where micropayments come in. That's really the segment that complements existing monetization models for publishers. So we have one publisher in Germany called Der Aktionär, which is the shareholder magazine of Germany. Mm-hmm. They are doing, in a way, our dream case of how they use our technology. They have a subscription, and on the page, when you are faced with the subscription, you know, login or sign up, called a paywall, they also offer, or you can just click here once with Satoshi Pay and read this one article. That's exactly what we want. We want to complement subscription systems and really kind of not disrupt too much the subscription or the advertising space, just kind of being a different way of monetizing the same content.
Yeah, it's a good idea. I know I would certainly pay like that for, you know, to read an article rather than have to subscribe to something, just for the reasons you've said. And in order to do that then, from like a user point of view, what would they need? They'd just need an account with you.
Correct. Yeah. So it's top up. Little bit of balance, of initial balance, or they get even a free giveaway. This publisher in Germany, they're giving away funds as well.
Okay.
This is done in collaboration with the Stellar Foundation, actually, which is generous enough to give us, I think, up to €10 per user. as a starting balance. I think it's even more in some cases. And so that's an easy way to get started. And then if you like the service, you can top up more, and you can even have like a regular, let's say, automatic withdrawals from your bank account or from your PayPal service.
Okay.
So that's the micropayment space and the competition there. And as I already mentioned, in the money transfer space, there's fierce competition, to be honest. It's everywhere. I mean, the bank around the corner competes with us. It is specialized services like TransferWise and Xoom and Skrill and all these services that are in the same space, all targeting slightly different geographies and slightly different industries and also market segments in terms of consumers. Most of them are focusing on consumers. A pure business focus, that's already making the field of competition smaller. So that's why we optimize for that. Also, a deep integration in, let's say, tax accounting software. That's something that consumer tools can't offer and that they don't offer. That's really where we come in. However, we have the advantage of offering this service cheaper and faster with the blockchain technology that we use. And in the space of digital wallets, we don't really compete because it's an open source product. It's in a way also marketing for us, but also almost a byproduct of what we're doing with our B2B service, that we need this wallet software anyway, and we integrate it deeply into our B2B software as well in the background. And that's really where our platform comes into place. We have an underlying platform, our backend platform, that connects all of these three different interfaces, and that's handling all the transactions with the blockchain and then sort of communicates it out to the different front ends via different APIs.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And if people want to find out a little bit more, then I've just been on the internet. You've got your main website, satoshipay.io, which I think is the main website where you offer your services. What about the Solar app then?
I mean, so there's this page that you just mentioned, satoshipay.io. Mm-hmm. It's really, we recently updated it to be a pointer into all of these three directions. So
okay.
We point people to the B2B service, we point them to the micropayment service, and we also... wallet service. So you will come to the different websites from there. So that's really our entry portal. We'll continue to have this sort of threefold strategy for quite some time.
Yeah, the three icons are on there, and it's a solar wallet that, for example, I would need to do a micropayment online with a publisher, for example.
No, you don't need the solar wallet for that. You can use it to receive funds as a publisher. You can use the solar wallet. But as someone that wants to pay on a website, you don't actually need that solar wallet. You just go to the website and then it's all handled from there. You don't need to download any software, just as someone that wants to spend funds. That's really where Solar links everything, right? So Solar is for a publisher to receive funds and also for a B2B business to top up their funds or also receive as a business on the other end. You can also use Solar.
I must need an account, though, I presume, Meinhard. So would I just sign up for an account when I was on the website that I wanted to buy an article off?
It's different for these three services. For the micropayment service, you can sign up on that website, which opens up the SatoshiPay wallet sign-up service.
Okay.
And you can then sign up for an account there. You give a username and password,
and then
you have an account there. Right. For B2B, currently there's no self sign up, so you have to go through our sales channels, and we kind of take you by the hand. And also, we use this as also market research. What kind of people approach us, what are the needs, and where are the difficulties that they have currently with existing payment solutions or money transfer solutions. So that's really why we work closely with our sales and growth team and our new clients in the B2B transfer.
Okay.
And for the digital wallet, solar wallet, you don't really need any sign up with us. You need to create a wallet, but that just lives on your device.
I see. Right. Okay.
I know all this terminology. I mean, for me, I'm already in this space for nine years. And for me, that's all clear, but I can understand for someone completely new to this. So what is even a wallet, and what's the difference between a wallet and a user account? That's all technical differences that need a bit of education, explanation. But for the B2B service, we want to really mask all that and make it just function like a normal service that you're used to, your online banking or your existing money transfer service. So you don't need to learn anything. We will completely hide everything that says blockchain and crypto behind just terminology that you're used to.
No, I understand that. I just always think from a sort of user point of view, how could I set up an account? But as you say, you just, when you went on a website, let's take, I don't know, a paper like the Times or something in the UK, that if they accepted your micropayments idea, then you just sign up when you went on to buy the article, I guess, which is right. Which is fine. Yeah, that makes sense then. Okay, that's cool. Yep. Okay, good. Kenny, did you want to come in?
Yeah, just one sort of final question. So who actually sets the value of a Satoshi Pay? So say, for instance, I wanted to buy an article, as Mark mentioned, in the Times, and let's say it cost, I don't know, 10 pence. How many Satoshi Pays is that equal to, or who sets that? Is it varied, or is it a fixed amount?
So this is really up to the publisher. And Satoshi Pay is just the service. We don't really have our own token. We call it Satoshi Pay credits, but these credits mm-hmm. are really linked to the Stellar cryptocurrency, and the price is being calculated in real time. So even we have different methods where it shows the value in Satoshi Pay credits, but also we have a different type of button that just shows the pound amount. So it says pay £1, pay 50p. And that's really set by the publisher, so they can decide if they want to have this Satoshi Pay credit denomination or if they want to just use the currencies that the users are used to.
All right. Okay.
So that it's up to sense. The publisher. We don't make the pricing. We're just the neutral universal payment service in the background.
Yeah. So the Satoshi credit can vary in value depending on how the Stellar network.
Yeah, correct. The Stellar Lumens price also, I mean, it's tied, the Satoshi Pay credit is tied to the Stellar Lumen. This is simply in a way to be more international. So we don't fix it to a dollar or euro or any other currency in the world. So this system can be used internationally, and it's always Satoshi Pay credits. That's kind of, we kind of borrow that from the computer games world where you have these gold tokens or coins. That's have sort of their own value, and that you have 100 tokens or 100 credits, and you can then spend them more easily. And you made that purchase decision once, and you have these 100 tokens. You don't with every microtransaction calculate how much would that be in pounds, because you don't really need to. You have made that purchase decision once. You want to invest £5 into this content system, and then you start spending these credits in that system. That was the thinking behind that.
Excellent. Well, I think we've pretty much had a very comprehensive overview of what you've done in your business journey, and we can clearly see or hear your passion for this business, and there's no doubt it's going to become a success over the next couple of years. Mark, have you got anything to finish off with?
I had something. I mean, I just following on from you, Kenny. Yeah, I'm keen to watch the space and see how it develops, Meinhard. But I'm keen just to maybe just go back to you personally just for a few minutes, if you don't mind. And when you mentioned you went travelling around the world, almost hitchhiking. And I did a bit of travelling when I was younger as well, probably not to the extent you did, but I'd just be quite keen to know, why you did that and how long you did it for, and really, any sort of interesting experiences stand out from that trip to you? Any interesting stories that you might have? It's always fun to hear them.
Sure. So I hope you have another 2 hours. This was extensive. I mean, so I did this for more than 10 years, almost 15 years.
I was a
digital nomad, and that was my lifestyle. I was running several ventures while I was traveling, sometimes with some more time, sometimes with less time. And I decided not to fly for about 10 years. So that was starting, I think, 2003 until 2013 or 12. I didn't fly at all. Okay. So that was a self-limitation I gave myself, just also to send an ecological mission or because I had the time, and this was a restriction that I gave myself and kind of to see what comes out of that. So that also meant that I had to travel overland, obviously, and I still traveled all the way to Japan without flying.
Okay.
And I took a foldable bicycle with me, sort of a Brompton, a German version of a Brompton. Mm-hmm. And I used that to put it on trains, and I cycled in Turkey, I cycled in Romania, I cycled in Russia, in China, Mongolia, Korea. And, you know, the long distances, the very long distance through Siberia would then obviously take a train. But this, you know, this trip alone took 2 years, and that was around 2012, 2013. Mm. And why did I do that? Kind of the adventure, obviously, that I was looking for. But also, you know, I wanted to connect all these places that you usually only see from the air. If you fly from here to Japan, you see it from the air. But everything, all the cultural changes and even climate changes in between that, you don't really see. And I wanted to experience that and kind of how one merges into the other. And then sometimes even there are hard cuts. If you take the border between Mongolia and China, for example, there's kind of a hard cut there. It's like, you know, you have... horses and yurts on one side, and then there's sort of a fence almost just, and you have like dirt tracks, and then like a fully developed high-tech city starts right at the border, which probably has the GDP of Mongolia as the whole country, which was quite astonishing. And for these adventures, also to learn about languages and, you know, also kind of the challenges of this world to see them. And that's also where I saw that, you know, currency and currency transfer is something that's a real challenge between all these countries. So yeah, as I said, on that trip alone, I think it was about 10 countries. So then I continued from Japan, where I took my first flight from Korea to Hong Kong. That was the only flight on that trip, simply because I couldn't get a visa for mainland China in Seoul easily. It would have taken weeks and weeks with sending my passport back to Germany.
Yeah,
and then I traveled from Hong Kong overland to Bali, with all the countries in between. So that was experiencing that part of the journey.
Wow.
And I lived in the UK for a while, I lived in Ireland for a while.
Okay.
And also, I was part of a recycling culture, and not just recycling, consumer goods, but also recycling food in a way. So there's so much food being thrown into bins and dumpsters. Yeah. And, that is perfectly fine. It just kind of find these resources. I mean, now I'm happy that this is more organized. Now there's like websites now where shop owners put their food that they would go give to the bins.
Yeah.
Normally they give it to people, so that's organized. But like 10 years ago, that didn't exist yet. Mm. So I'd like to think that kind of I also inspired maybe this in some of the shop owners that I met.
Yeah.
But also in recycling living space. So so let's say a sort of negative term for this would be squatting. But we would use some unused space that has been dormant for many, many years, fix it up and kind of live there temporarily. And as soon as someone had a legitimate claim to that space, we would also move out. I even did that in London, right? So there is definitely this culture of using resources efficiently. And that's often not seen as just the negative part. Or, you know, there's these people that take away things from other people, but it's really not what it's about. And that's not really what I wanted to do anyway. So that was part of my living very efficiently with very little resources.
Okay. Did you earn money when you were doing it, or how did it work?
So I did some freelancing for NGOs, and also had this web hosting service that was generating a bit of income. I did also do some open source freelancing. Sometimes I would go back a few months to Germany, work on a project for a publisher integrating a content management system, for example. And so that's kind of where I had my strong exposure to the publishing world as well. And I kind of learned how publishing works and how the monetization of publishing or of content really causes some difficulty sometimes.
That's great. That's really good. I bet there was that's an experience of a lifetime. That's really cool. That's great.
And what I learned there replaced many years of studying for sure. And in terms of geography, languages, economies, anthropology, all these things I really kind of learned along the way.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's really cool. I'd like to discuss that more hopefully we can meet up one day. That would be fascinating to know. I bet you must have a lot of stories to tell. Incredible.
I'm blogging It's 99 when it wasn't called blogging. So if you go to ben.org, BENN.org, that's my last name, .org.
Okay.
These old travel stories, if you're interested in that.
Okay. Yeah, I will check that out. I'll check that out. Great. Okay. No, that's really good. It'd been nice talking to you, Meinhard.
Sure. No worries at all. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Really appreciate the time. I think we're coming up in an hour now. So that's probably a good time to finish the podcast, and I appreciate the time out of your busy day, Meinhard, and hopefully we can get you back on again when the maybe in 6 months, 9 months, when the business is moving on, we can get an update. So thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much again, Meinhard. And yeah, as Kenny said, hopefully we'll catch up again in a few months' time. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much as well. And it's always a pleasure to talk about my, let's say, unusual entrepreneurial path so far. So thank you for that.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Perfect. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.